history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who have gone through truly extraordinary things on our behalf. And hearing about their experiences is good for the rest of us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and yeah, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you caught our last episode, you heard a pioneering African-American heart surgeon named Bert Marius share some of his story. If you missed it, pull up episode number 509 at hometownheroesradio.com and make sure you catch the bizarre situation in which being categorized as a Caucasian almost ended up costing him his life. We're going to hear about some more life or death situations today. Some of them may be similar to stories you've heard before. Others may come as a little shocking. Bert had initially enlisted in the Army Specialized Training Program with the hopes of an accelerated path through medical school. He ended up in a segregated unit called the 725th Medical Sanitary Company, with whom he would see duty throughout the Pacific, the Solomon Islands, the Russell Islands, Iwo Jima, the Philippines, and more.
After the basic training, which took about 3 months, they shipped us up to a camp in Pennsylvania. And then after we left there, then they shipped us down to an area right outside of Stockton, California, and they boarded us on a ship. We went from there, first landed in Hawaii. I finally wound up in New Caledonia. And New Caledonia is a French-influenced area. And it was very interesting because the United States of America had an armed depot there, you know, that they collected things and then so on down the line. But they needed, you know, translators. And, of course, they looked at my record. And even though the Army was segregated, you know, I spoke French. So they put me in there to be as an interpreter to the people who in that area who were working there who spoke French. Now, the other interpreter who was there was a white lieutenant from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he happened to be teaching language, and French was one of the languages he taught in the University of Mississippi. But he grew up in Mississippi. He had, of course, a Mississippian accent. So even when he spoke French, you heard the Mississippi accent in it. Like, if you want to say, do you want something to eat in French? Say, est-ce que vous voulez quelque chose pour manger maintenant? Okay, you want something to eat right now. Well, he said, in his French southern accent, est-ce que vous voulez chose pour manger maintenant? First time I've ever heard French spoken with a southern accent. And they couldn't understand him. And they would turn to me and say, qu'est-ce qu'il dit? What did he say? But I had to be very careful. I had to whisper to them in French, I'll explain to you later. Because I didn't want to explain nothing in front of him. After, you know, he'd finished and told him all he wanted to do, then I would go off someplace and they'd follow me. And then I would tell them in French that they could understand. But I knew better to embarrass him.
Sure.
Because he was a lieutenant, and I was nothing but a private. Mm-hmm. So anyway, after that is when we moved to places like Guadalcanal and all that sort of stuff, and there were all kinds of experiences. And since we had medical associated with us, they did not arm us.
And let's explain that for people listening. So you're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we would, to get rid of them, we had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff, and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw. So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only 3 of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had 3 left. Yeah. So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many enough of these mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases and all those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself. And but the whole issue is, you know, and we went in on the invasion of Cebu and Leyte and in the Philippines and so on down the line. And as a matter of fact, when we were in Batangas on Leyte, is where we were staying, the 101st Airborne, we heard that they had decided to attack us. And they came by with machine guns and everything like that. And fortunately, we had heard that they were going to. So we had gone to a storage area there, and we talked the guys into giving us guns and stuff. And so we were able to shoot back and ward them off and stuff. But they came, the 101st Airborne came through there with motor vehicles and all that stuff to wipe us out completely.
Why would they do that?
Because we were colored and they were white.
Now, I know you've told me a lot of stuff that most people have never heard before, but that's, I mean, I don't think I'd ever consider that. And I've talked to 101st Airborne guys.
The 101st Airborne was both in the Pacific and in Europe. Yeah. All right. So it's the particular groups that you're dealing with.
So what did you guys hear, and why did you believe that your own men would come after you guys?
Well, because, number one, when we were camped in Pennsylvania, they also did some attacking on blacks. So some of it happened right here in the United States of America. And it also happened in the capital of the Philippines.
What happened in Pennsylvania? Was this while you were there? You saw and heard about this?
Yeah. Some whites attacked, and they had German prisoners there. And they treated the German prisoners better than they treated the black troops. See, back then, when they talked about prejudice and segregation, they weren't jiving. They meant it 100%. The young blacks today have no concept of what segregation really is.
And where was that in Pennsylvania?
Camp Reynolds, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So when you say they attacked some of the blacks. Mm-hmm. People actually die or just wounded or what?
Oh, yeah, they kill some. But you see, it's hard to believe, you know, today. It's hard for me to explain that to young people today because young people today tend to make a universal attitude about something. Mm-hmm. Now, you got a certain a group of people acting a certain way, and they apply that to every white person. So, you know, to tell them that, you know, say, this doesn't mean that every white person has that kind of attitude. Now, most of the whites in the Army, no. All of the 101st Airborne did not have that attitude. You know, so don't blame that on the whole 101st Airborne. These are certain group of the 101st Airborne that acted that way. Just stop and think about it. We're out of slavery in America, not only because blacks stood up for what they wanted to stand up for, but because you had certain groups of white people who went to work to change that situation. So, you know, they say, well, whites this and whites that. Well, of course, you had whites in that wrong thing, but you also had whites doing what is right. So you have to judge people, you know. It's like I have old saying, and I say, figures don't lie, but liars sure enough can figure.
That explains it. And so what you're saying here in the Philippines is that you guys, as an all-black unit, hear that some bad actors have it out for you and are actually going to come fire on you guys, even though you have no weapons.
They thought we had no weapons, but we did.
Because you heard they were coming.
Yeah. But besides that, we had gotten weapons not only because of that, but we had gotten weapons because even though they didn't arm us, they sent us in areas where snipers were shooting at us, and we couldn't protect ourselves, and they didn't send troops to protect us.
And I'll step away from that specific instance for a moment to ask you a general question. Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that? Did you feel like you guys were second class or expendable or sacrificial lambs?
No, that is not the kind of attitude that we blacks took at that time. When you were in the Army, and of course you had a whole different attitude about your enemy. Now, World War II was about the end of true world wars, true war. In World War II, the people you fought against was your enemy. Your job was to kill all of them or get killed and control all of them or be controlled. Not like today, where they go into these various places, allow them to continue to operate and help them trying to operate the right way. When we went into the Army of Occupation in Japan, and I was in the Army of Occupation with Douglas MacArthur, Doug MacArthur took over the government completely. And so it was a whole different attitude.
So you're saying that even though you guys weren't a combat unit, you actually engaged in combat with the Japanese?
We engaged. They were the enemy. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. Right. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. Just go out. Just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce. But you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today.
But just so I'm clear, even before this incident with the 101st Airborne, you guys, for your own self-preservation, had found weapons here and there?
Oh, yeah.
And did you have to use them against the Japanese?
Of course. We got in positions we had to use them to save our lives. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And how terrifying was that whole situation for you to be in those situations so far from home, knowing that any day could be your last?
Well, you had an attitude, and I know, and I can only talk about my own attitude. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
And what would you say were the times you look back on now as the close calls, as the closest you came to not coming home?
Well, one of the closest was when we hit Cebu City. We were on the ship, and we were not supposed to leave the ship because there were snipers in the city. But a group of us got together and said, Lord, you know, we've been all this time in the South Pacific and stuff, and of course, you know, the inhabitants were moved away, and we never ran across any women or anything like that, you know, and so on down the line, except, you know, nurses and stuff in the army. So, man, you know, we get into Cebu City, we might find some nice women we can work with. So what we did, we volunteered to help take some of the things off the ship, you know, down to the port. And, of course, what we had planned is once we got down on the port, we would take off to Cebu City. So we were there sitting down in this square in Cebu City. We were there and we're drinking our booze and talking about, you know, where we're going to go to hunt up the women. And all of a sudden, the snipers opened on us.
As you might imagine, that did not end well. We'll hear the rest of that story and the difficult lesson he learned there when we come back, plus some of the other hazards he faced and the ways Bert found to help his fellow troops in that segregated unit. Find photos and videos of Dr. Marius at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.